Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Life is full of what ifs. Some awesome. Like what if AI could fold your laundry? And some, well, less awesome. Like what if you have unexpected medical costs? UnitedHealthcare can help get you covered with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. They supplement your primary plan to help you manage out-of-pocket costs. No deductibles, no enrollment periods, and especially no more what ifs. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Insightful, fun conversations with some of the best LGBTQ writers from around the world. The Illusions Podcast.
Welcome back into the House of Mystery. I'm Al Warren, Mr. Dave, Two Quick Hands, Martino.
Oh.
Yeah, Quick Hands. Fast.
Quick Hands.
Fast. You're quickie.
Slow Hands.
You're quick quickie. Hands. Not a good cookie. No. Karate. The Karate Kid. Right. Eight.
Eight?
Yeah. Aren't you taking over that movie or that series?
I should be.
Yeah. You're taking over that kid. Why am I not? Yeah. He's getting too old. You fit in, you know. You're faster. You're better anyway.
I have the mentality of a 15-year-old, so that would be perfect.
Yeah, and you have the sticks.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, the Kali sticks are
going screaming. Back to Kelly. Yeah. Kelly. Kelly.
Man, I don't think so.
Nah. Man. Actually, we did originally have the guy book that lit himself on fire in front of the Trump trial, but he couldn't make it due to, a hospital and some circumstances. So instead, we've got a writer, and he's got a new book out. Sulphur Springs Cure. Mr. Jeffrey Round, how are you doing?
I am doing really well. Great to be here, guys.
Yeah, sit down, relax.
You were doing well.
I stand warned.
What's been going on? What's going on? I haven't talked to you. It's been like three years, maybe longer.
It has been a good long while. No, I peek in on you, not in person, but to your podcasts, just to get a sense of what's going on. So I was just listening to your podcast about the Russell Williams book and had some surprises there, things I didn't know about, even as a good Canadian, things that you think I would know from CBC, but they didn't reveal certain things, but So no, I check in on you. I'm distant but not gone. I think we can put it that way.
Ooh, I can sense your presence. Ooh, it's like a big night creeping in, slowly getting darker. Listen, what did you do here? What do you call this? Historical fiction? Do you think?
Historical fiction, hysterical fiction. You could call it a lot of things. I try to resist labels, or I pile so many on that, nobody can actually pull it apart. It was a book that, shall we talk about where the book came from?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, where would you get the idea for something like this?
It started, maybe around 2008, 2009, with my mother saying, when are you going to write a book that doesn't have quite so much sex and violence in it? Mom, that would be really boring, so probably never. Yeah. And no one would buy it if I did. And she said, no, I think you should do that. And she turned out to be very right. It wasn't boring, and somebody did buy it. But the second impetus for the book, The Sulphur Springs Cure, was my boredom. Because I kept saying, I'm bored, I'm just tired of being in the city, let's do something. And a friend said, why don't we go for a walk at the Sulphur Springs? And I said, well, what's that? And he said, come along and find out. It turns out it's a trail outside of Hamilton, Ontario, people will know of Hamilton. Fewer people will know about Ancaster or Dundas Valley. But it's actually on the edge of Dundas Valley. It was a resort. It was a spa, a restorative health spa in the 1870s and 1890s. And it was quite famous because a lot of people swore that it was a cure. You would go there and you would soak in the sulfur waters and you would come away and say, oh, my arthritis is gone, or, you know, my husband is gone. You know, whatever you wanted to disappear would be gone, right? So it was quite the going concern. I had never heard of it. We went to the grounds and we were walking around and you would go through these beautiful sunlit glades where all the birds would be going tweet, 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 tweet. And it would be all really nice and sunny. Then you would walk 3 yards in another direction. Suddenly it was like gloom and doom and Trollsville, and the sounds were strange and everything was murky and under moss. And it had incredible atmosphere. And as we were walking along, we came to the ruins of the actual Sulphur Springs Hotel, which had burned down in the early part of the 20th century. And I just stared at it, and I was fascinated because I felt vibes from this place, but I also felt like I was listening to voices from the past coming out of the grounds. And by the time I went home, but an hour later, I thought, I've got the story that my mother wants me to write. I actually took a name, a first name from an historic plaque. A woman named Violet, I don't remember her real last name, had donated a lot of money for the restoration of the grounds, not the hotel itself. The grounds was, the hotel was in ruins, but the grounds were still in great shape because she and a lot of people had donated some money to keep these properties up. But I thought, Violet, what a great name. It's just, you know, it's redolent of the late 1800s, early 1900s. There aren't many people named Violet now. You know, a few poison ivies and whatnot, but not too many violets. And so I took her name, and she quickly became a character in my head. And I was suffering from wicked insomnia at the time, and I would wake up and I would be thinking about Violet, and I'd be, you know, like cursing my lack of sleep. And I think, well, Violet's probably an insomniac too. You know, she'd be going through what I was going through. And this character started to develop, and I thought, okay, let's talk about what happened and when it happened and why she is waking up in these, you know, in these moments of insomnia and saying, I need to solve this problem from the past. And that is basically the genesis of the story and where the story came from, because she was not a participant in, but she was involved in a murder that happened in 1939 at the Sulphur Springs Hotel. But 70 years later, 2009, she's saying it's still unsolved. I can't die until this thing is solved. And that's where the book starts off.
So did you actually get into the springs? Is it still there? And did it make you feel better?
That's a no answer / yes answer. Okay. So the springs, you can access them. There is still, it's kind of like a drinking fountain. You can actually press a button, the water comes out, you can drink this stuff. It's not, unless you've got a tank full, it's not enough to bathe in. So I didn't do that. It actually stank so much. I didn't smell it. I didn't taste it, but I smelled it and I thought, oh, this is really vile. I wonder how people actually tolerate this. And I went online and I saw that some people still to this day, they drink it as a tonic. Now, flash forward to February of this year, which is quite a few years later. I was in Costa Rica, and I was staying with some friends near the volcano Arenal. And there are hot springs there that are heated by the volcano. And I swear, each time I dipped in one of those pools, I felt 10 years younger for about a week afterwards. So if you want to know if I believe in spring curative values, I would say absolutely.
Well, there you have it. Now we know.
Now you know.
Secret.
You're packing your bags right now, going down there. I can tell. You want to go dip your toes in the springs, right?
yeah. I want to wake up 20, but it's not going to happen. So Violet, who is she then? Like, what does she do? What is she? Is she a dancer? Is she like a sewer? Like, what is her job?
She's retired when the book opens. She's 84 years old. She is a former teacher. She does volunteer work, and she has recently been widowed and lost her sister. So she's losing everybody who matters to her. But she has a niece, Claire, who's in her 30s, who comes to visit. And, you know, Claire thinks she's coming to help her pack up her house and sell the house and go into retirement, which is one of the things she's struggling about, because she really doesn't want to do this. But everybody's saying, oh, Aunt Vi, you're old now. You need to be careful. You drink too many gin and tonics. We need to put you in the home, right? So this is part of the inspiration for her to go back and say, listen, I still have one more thing I want to do before I go into this home. But she does have a very active and fun social life. She's a bit of a crab apple. She doesn't take easily to people. So when she does some physical fitness training in a pool at the Y, the local Y, she's approached by this woman named Sheila Dufresne, who says, oh, listen, I think you should join our Aqua Fitness group. We're a bunch of oldies. We call ourselves the Silver Swans, right? And Violet is at first thinking, what do I want to do with the, I don't want to be with these silly old women. But she agrees to try it once and realizes they're actually a lot of fun. So they're kind of, it's not like they help her solve the mystery of what happened, but she spins out her stories and her tales, and she tells them, and they go, oh, did you know about this? Did you know about that? Not so much factual, but psychological, that puts her in a frame of mind to say, oh, that reminds me of so-and-so who was at the hotel at the time of the murder, or this reminds me of this person, or this is what I did, this is what I said. So this socializing is part and parcel of her solving the mystery.
So did they all have sex while they were in the pool?
The elderly ladies?
Yeah, yeah.
One of them gets a flotation tube trapped between her legs at one point, and she comes up screaming, that's the most fun I've had in years.
Perfect.
So maybe.
That sounds good.
Maybe.
Yeah, I thought that, the X-rated version of the book, maybe they all go wild or something. I don't know.
No, that would go against my mother's wishes. I wouldn't have done that.
Well, she doesn't get the X-rated version. She just gets the regular version where there's sweet old ladies in the pool.
Yeah. No, they're not sweet. They're pretty salty, these ladies. They make a lot of jokes about sex. One of the things they talk about, and it's a women only, so that, the men become the targets. So they have these flotation devices, these tubes, and people who practice this form of exercise, they're called noodlers. But apparently there's another kind of noodling, which comes partly from the Deep South in the U.S., where men will fish for catfish by dangling their noodles, basically. So, or their noodles, I guess we should say, to be. So anyway, they have a good gab about that. There's a little laugh about, oh, the other kind of noodling. Right. Got it. No, we're the first kind. We only do exercises in pools. We don't catch catfish with our genitals.
Well, that's another book. So how do you get into the headset of the woman, the females that you're writing, and write from their point of views? And Violet, is it in first person? Is it Violet point of view throughout the book? And if it is, how did you get into her and speaking in her voice?
Well, I like to write books from a perspective, right? I don't like to jump back and forth between characters. That's just my thing. That's what I do. I find it concentrates the story better for me. Violet, I had no problem accessing her story. I don't know how to say it anymore. Some days when I was writing it, it was kind of like I was downloading something from the computer. It was just coming through my head. All I was doing was typing, going, Well, that's very interesting. I wonder what I would think about that if I were actually the person to think about it, because it comes through as the character. I think it's a little bit like method acting. I allow the character come through me, and what I do not do at the time, I do not judge it. I just let it come through, and I say, okay, yeah, okay, I hear you. Yeah, I'm writing that down, but I'm going to check it later just in case, because I don't want to say anything that's going to make me look like an idiot. So it's kind of like a channeling. And I had no problem in being that woman. I think I want to say it like that. So, and she was quite happy to embody me.
Right. You wore a dress and a wig and the whole thing.
I didn't even need the props.
Acted it out. No. Well, I'd say, and why is she a teacher? Was there a particular reason that she was a teacher?
There is a lot of talk about, you know, women were allowed to do this back then. Women weren't allowed to do that. We're talking about the 30s, basically. Her father was a teacher, had come through the Great Depression. He was a biology teacher. And Violet has a fascination for science. She calls it her first love, but she says her second love was Shakespeare. So I allowed her to teach both subjects, because back then, if I had in particular a small school where my mother grew up in rural Nova Scotia. It was a two-story school, but all the grades were either on the first floor or the second floor. And when I'm saying it's small, I mean, it's a really tiny place. So it's not like the high schools today where, you know, you're all spread out. It's kind of like you're in one room or you're in another room. So probably downstairs you would have grades 1 to 5, and upstairs you would have grades 6 to 9 or whatever it would be, right? So I imagined that, and I thought, well, if you're a teacher, it's not like, you know, you teach 9:30 to 10:30 and then Miss Barrett comes in teaching math from 10:30 to 11:30. You're going to be teaching everything that you actually know about, and it's so there was a great deal of versatility that was required to be that sort of teacher. Plus, you're also like a substitute mother to half of these kids, and you know, worrying, are they properly dressed in the cold, and are they getting enough to eat? Stuff that still goes on today, though, as we well know. It was the classroom that I had in mind. But one of the interesting things that I came across when I was researching this was women in the night. Well, let's say prior to the end of World War II, women were told, you have to make a choice. You can either be the mother of the children you teach, or you can be the mother of your own children, but you can't really, they were believed not to be able to divide their attention and their loyalties between two broods, the ones at school and the ones at home. So you were supposed to make a choice. And because Violet's parents were very progressive in many ways, they said, no, what do you want to do? You can do what you want to do. And, you know, back in that era when that sort of thinking was very much frowned upon, especially by women, but even, you know, even by men to a certain degree. So that's where it comes from. So it's kind of a rebelliousness on her part to say, I am going to be a married woman and I'm also going to be a teacher. Now, she doesn't end up having children of her own. That was not a choice. I think she and her husband wanted to be parents, but they weren't. So,
when you're putting this story together, did you come up with some sort of subtext or some sort of meaning for it? Is there something more than just the entertainment and the mystery involved in this story? Do you have a deeper meaning?
Yeah. Okay. Let's go back a little bit to my explanation that I wrote it because of what my mother said, please write a book with less sex and violence, or none if you can. I did do that, and it was very much a Miss Marple-style mystery. And I presented it to my publisher at the time, and they said, oh, no, you know, your stuff is sex and violence. We can't do this, you know. So I thought, okay, fine, put it in the drawer. My mother's happy. She read it. Done, right? In 2022, I believe, yes, 2022, a different publisher came to me and said, we really like your writing, and, you know, we've published some of your stuff in the past, But do you have anything that's a little lighter than your current stuff, maybe with less sex and violence?
Your mother was out doing work there.
And I realized the tide had turned. Okay, so this is, I mean, we're talking a dozen years later, pretty much. The tide had turned, and part of what turned it was a series of books coming out of England called The Thursday Murder Club Mysteries. They are mysteries that are solved by four geriatrics who live in a retirement home. And so the author's name is Richard Osman, and they are spectacularly funny. They're mostly comedies. So I realized there would, and they sell in the gazillions. I mean, he talks in his afterwards, in his thank yous, about how shocked he is about how well these things sell. But what the publisher, Marcote Cormorant, said to me was, he said, he looked at the book, and I gave it to him, and I said, listen, I have hesitation about this book, because I don't think it's as good as the stuff I'm writing. He said, let me be the judge of that. And I thought, okay, fine, let's do that. Gave him the book, and he got back to me in about a month, and he said, I think what I'm reading is a literary novel buried under a mystery. And suddenly this thing in my head went kaboom, and I thought, that's what I'm missing. He said, why don't you concentrate a little bit more on the literary side of the book and let the mystery play itself out? And that was the key to me unleashing the book that it is today, which I'm very, very proud of. I have no qualms about saying I'm very proud of this book. I'm very happy with the way it turned out. But that was because he gave me permission to take it in a different direction that I didn't realize I was struggling against. So there's that.
Well, so basically he said, you can't write. Can you write better than this? And then you did.
That would be putting words in his mouth, but you might be right.
Oh, it's terrible like that. So now, what is your relationship with your character? How do you describe your relationship with the character? Do you hear her, see her, feel her, watch her like a movie? What's that process like?
You mean now that the book is out, or during writing?
Now that it's out, or even during, you can, you know, however you want to describe that relationship, you know, while you're writing it, or even now that the book is done. You know, is she still around, or do you snuff her out? Like, what goes on?
She makes it to the last page of the book, so I didn't kill her off. I'm very soft hearted with my characters. I don't like killing them if they don't deserve it. So, she is not around so much anymore. But I think I would take you back when I was first writing the book. She was in my head a lot. I was, you know, as I was saying, it was like a download. Suddenly there were these scenes and passages. I thought, I don't know where these come from, but they sound good, so let's get them down. So then the book went in the drawer for a decade, and then it got brought out again, and I had to find out who she was again, all over again. And also, you have to keep in mind, she's not just an 84-year-old. She's an 84-year-old for half the book, but interspersed in the chapters, she's a 14-year-old exploring what's going on at the Sulphur Springs Hotel, which is how she gets involved in the murder. She's too clever for her own good, and she starts following this trail of notes that is being left between people, and she thinks, oh, I'm going to find out about this. And because it's at the onset to World War II, she thinks one of the people leaving the notes is a spy. So she gets a little too involved. And then the murder happens, and she feels responsible for it. But when I began to revive the character, I had to take her on all over again, and she was there. But what I would say is that I do that with any character in any book that I'm writing. So that's not an unusual thing. I would say now Violet is not around me, though I have felt compelled to pick up the book and read it four times since it was published, and I never do that. It's just that I really like her company, and I really like her character. I thought, I need a little dose of Violet today, you know, so someone to set the world. She's like Miss Marple. She sets the world right. She doesn't do a lot. She says a few things that get people scurrying, right? And you think, oh, thank God there's a Miss Marple in the universe. It makes sense of a lot of things that we don't necessarily like. Can I take this a little bit further, though, if that's all right?
Absolutely not. Yeah, of course.
Dan Sharp, my character Dan Sharp, who is the lead character in 7 books, this Dan Sharp Mysteries, it's a 3-time Lamb.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
The nominee series, one-time winner. I didn't set out to write a series when I was writing the first Dan Sharp book, but it just obsessed me. I couldn't stop writing this book for about a year. It came out and I thought, oh, this is really good. Let's get it out there. And fortunately, it did get picked up by a publisher and then won an award and then got nominated for 2 more. But Dan was in my head for the decade that it took me to write those 7 books. And then once the 7th book came out, he vanished. He literally stopped talking in my head. And I've not heard from him since, not a postcard, not a phone call, not a, I miss you, love you, goodbye, nothing. And I actually felt bereft for about a year. It's kind of like, oh, it's like I've lost a friend. So I think that's a very extreme example of what you go through. But that was 7 books, right? So Violet so far has only been 1 book. So maybe she'll come back with another story. Who knows? She's a bit of a busybody. If she stumbles across another corpse, you can be guaranteed I'm going to hear about her.
So you can actually hear your characters in your head. You have an inner monologue. And is that how you do the prose as well? Do you kind of listen and then transcribe? Or is it more what you see? Because I know you had said earlier, too, that you're also a photographer. Do you see the scenes like a snapshot? Or how does that work?
Sometimes I see things in the back of my head, like you're remembering, you know, something that happened when you were 5 years old. Oh yeah, that cute dog that I had, blah, blah, blah. So I will have the visuals. In the case of the Sulphur Springs, when I go somewhere, I take photographs. That's just what I do. And so I had a repository of photographs when I came home from the walk that day, which I still have. So those images are stuck in my head too. In terms of the dialogue, I definitely hear people talking. The first Dan Sharp mystery, the first scene with Dan in it, it's not the prologue. In the prologue, it's somebody in the past contemplating suicide. Then we cut to the actual Dan Sharp story. He is sitting on his back patio with his friend Donnie. Donnie is he's Jamaican, but he's Canadian Jamaican. And they're sitting and they're talking about, can you tell whether a jazz horn player is black or white by the sound of the horn? And so they're having this little banter back and forth because Donnie's a horn aficionado and Dan says, well, I want you to prove that you can do this. I'm going to play some selections. You tell me who's playing. And Donnie is 90% right about who he guesses, but he makes a very fatal error on one of them and Dan says, you can't, right? So that conversation, I was coming home from a place outside of Peterborough where my family lived at the time. I was driving home and I had a Dizzy Gillespie CD on my car stereo. And I was listening to it and I thought, oh, listen to that sound. That's a sound that a black man would make. Could a white man make that? And suddenly I had this conversation in my head and I thought, who the hell are these people? Because they were literally having an argument. It was a friendly argument, but it was a fun argument. I thought, I think these are the characters that I've been waiting for to put into this. I had already had a backbone of a story, but I didn't know anything more about this person got murdered. Boom. I didn't have anything more. And suddenly the characters were sliding into place because of this Dizzy Gillespie CD on my car stereo. But I heard them. It's like they were behind me in the back seat. I could almost say, you kids shut up and sit down back there because you're pissing me off. So it was very vivid. The prose can be very spontaneous, but it's usually the editing process that gets it to the point where I hone it to a sentence that I think that's a good sentence, right? Because I'm also a poet, I'm very word sensitive. It's got to be the right word or I will throw the entire sentence out. So the hard work comes with the editing of the prose, not the imagining of the prose. I think that's how I would sum that up. And you, of course, write the nonfiction version of what I'm doing. So you need very much to stick to fact. So you're operating from a totally different part of your brain, I'm assuming.
I don't have a brain, so it's fine.
They took that away too, did they? Wow. Okay. I was going to say, must have been all those things you post on Facebook. They said, okay, take this guy's dangerous. Let's take his tools.
Yeah, I am dangerous. You know, I try to let people know, but they don't believe me until it's too late. But, you know, when you write fiction like this, you have more control then over as compared to nonfiction, right? Because you can change how it ends. You can decide who the murderer is. You can decide what happened. And you can also create a sense of justice of somewhat, whereas I can't really do that.
Right. No, I mean, you're stuck with a story. I mean, you can slant it in a direction, you know, like, okay, so here's the aftermath. Did anything good come from this? Or was anybody comforted? Or was it just, you know, a total apocalypse? So you have to deal with that. In terms of what I do though, again, it comes back to, am I writing it or am I actually channeling it? And I'm never sure. I don't have an answer for that. But if I try to make a character do something they don't want to do, they will fight back. That's the only way I can put it. I remember writing an entire scene with Dan thinking, he's got to do this because this fits in with the plot and this is where I'm going. But it was like, yuck. I'm not comfortable with this. I don't like this. And basically I got to the end of the scene and Dan was like, I'm not happy. So I said, okay, what do you want? Because I need to get over this bridge to get the plot going again, right? And so I thought, okay, I'm not going to fight with this. I need this scene. It's going to stay in. I showed it to my editor, and she said, no, you know, I don't think Dan would do that. It's not believable what you've got him doing here. And I said, well, what are my options? And she said, why don't you ask him? And so I said, okay, if you come up with another solution, I'll write another scene. And lo and behold, about 2 days later, I thought, Oh, right. This takes it in a totally different direction. And what a better direction it is. So I'm, you know, I'm stuck with certain rules that cannot be broken as well. They're very much psychological rules. Your character wouldn't do this because that's not what your character does, right? In one, this is, and sorry, I keep going back to Dan, but I'm sure you don't mind, but in one case, Dan helped solve a murder that CSIS, the Canadian Security Intelligence Services, was involved. They were kind of trying to usurp him, but they knew he was the key to solving the mystery. So they wait for him to solve it, and then they slap this non-disclosure agreement in front of him. And I thought, no, Dan would never sign that. But the threats they are making are quite credible, and there's no way he could have got out of signing that agreement. He would not be allowed to basically walk on the street without signing the agreement. They weren't going to let him go. And I took it to this editor. She was very perceptive, and she said, no, this is the legality in Canada. If you want to break the rules fictionally, she said, you can do it, but it's not credible to you as an author because you're supposed to know that he can't get away with that. Well, because this was, I believe, in the third book, something, the third of the seven books. Because of that, I came up with the plot for the seventh book in which Dan finally gets the, he turns the tables on CSIS at the end of the seventh book. So, and that came because I forced him, well, he was forced to sign this non-disclosure agreement about who did what with which to whom. Because what happened was they allowed somebody else to be killed in order to catch the person they were trying to catch. And that's what Dan was not allowed to talk about. So anyway, I got a whole seventh book because of it. So yeah,
that's all right. No, you can talk about Dan anytime. Dan Sharp is living with me now. That's why he doesn't contact you anymore.
Is he still a crap cook?
Yeah. Don't let him cook. Yeah, that's all right. I do all the cooking, right? So, do you think about the reader when you're putting together a book like this? Are you thinking about, is the reader standing over your shoulder, and are you thinking about what they're going to think or react to when you're writing?
That's a multifaceted question. I never want to bore anybody. Am I afraid of offending somebody? Absolutely not. I'm quite thrilled to be able to do it. When I first started writing mysteries, I didn't take them seriously. My first mystery was called The P-Town Murders. It's my other series, the Bradford Fairfax Murder Mystery series. And so they were comic mysteries. And I thought, okay, well, that's as close as a mystery to a mystery as I'm going to get. And then I started taking them more and more seriously. But I had always heard this thing that you need to write for your ideal reader. And I never believed that. I thought, no, I'm writing for everybody. I want, you know, fill the universe with love and joy, and they can all read my books, blah, 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 blah. So I thought, okay, I'm going to try this ideal reader thing because I don't really trust my abilities as a mystery writer. I thought, who would I most want to impress writing a comedy? And I thought, oh, Oscar Wilde. So every scene, I thought, would Oscar approve of this? Would Oscar think this is funny? I kept trying to top him. You know, his short stories, the picture of Dorian Gray, things like that. And of course, the plays were there too. So Oscar was always at my elbow going, that's not really funny. Try this word, or give this character a funny hat, or, you know, make this character say that. So that was extremely helpful to me. It actually gave me confidence because by the time I was finished, I thought, this is pretty damn funny. And if Oscar doesn't like it, he can piss up a rope.
So. Well. No wonder these people leave.
So yes, I do now think very much of the reader. Yeah, I should charge them rent.
You should. Yeah, there's only so much room there, too, right?
And they won't eat very much.
No.
By the way, can I put this? Can I plug a TV show right now? Actually,
yeah, why not?
Okay, so I watch Netflix. You know, there's my disclosure. I just came across this thing called Dead Boy Detectives. It's on Netflix. It's two boy detectives who are dead. So think of Frank and Joe Hardy, dead and British, and they've got this sidekick who is psychic. She's alive and she's American and she's Nancy Drew. So it's the Hardy Boys dead team up with Nancy Drew live. And it's really funny and it's very sexy. It's a very sexy show.
Well, there you go. My nipples are hard. I'm excited.
Let's keep it there.
Yeah. Well, that's, you know, that's as far as they go anyway. Listen, comedy, humor is very important to you.
Yes.
Why do you think that is? And what do you include it in all of your books? Do you put some sort of sense of humor, let's just say, rather than comedy, let's say, in your books, in your stories?
I would say that I do. Maybe you need to ask a reader that. Why is it important to me? Because I grew up in some of the most boring places in Canada, and I was always looking for something to spark my imagination. So humor was always part of that. I can't put it in any other terms, but I always look for what is fun, what is enjoyable. Let's not get bogged down. We're all depressed. The world is, you know, about to blow itself up, but let's at least find some bright moments, you know, in the darkness if we can. So I guess that's where it comes from.
Well, do you think you need a sense of...
Yeah. Does he need professional help? Definitely. But I can't afford it, so I write books.
Right. It's its own sort of therapy.
It is, absolutely, yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Do you feel you need to have a sense of comedic timing to put humor into prose fiction, or is it truth telling? How do you approach it?
Good question. I often read books where I'll come across a sentence and I'll think, oh, the author thinks he or she is funny, but they need to tweak that to make me laugh because it doesn't punch me in the face. And that's what I want. So I'm always looking for that, I guess. And it really goes back to this, find a way to brighten your day, for God's sake, because, you know, just going out in the traffic in Toronto, I want to murder half the city half the time. So I always look for a fun moment somewhere. But the words are extremely important. One word would be funny, whereas two can be sometimes twice as funny, or, you know, you add three and suddenly the whole sentence sinks. So you have to be aware of the comic weight of something. I think I write prose like stand-up comedians would write their jokes, and on a good night they fly, and on a bad night, you know, you go down with lead boots.
So what's a good book to you? What does Jeffrey like reading?
I read everything. And that's not a cop out answer. I like to read these days. I like to read a lot of nonfiction. It doesn't have to be crime. I like to read a lot of nonfiction because it takes me places and introduces me to people who might tell me something that I will be interested in hearing about or knowing. For instance, I'm a big Proust fan, Marcel Proust, but I've read the books three times. I don't want to read them again. They take me 5 years to read the series every bloody time. I don't, you know, how many more 5 year, you know, 5 year segments of my life can I devote to reading Proust? None. But I read about him, and I read about his time in Paris, which took him up. I believe he died in 21 or 22, maybe 1922. But lately, I picked up for $5. I couldn't believe the price on it. A hardcover. It's called Proust's Duchess, and it's this most incredibly researched book on who the three women were that Proust based his character, the Duchess. If you know the series, she's a not very nice person. She's snobbish and she's cruel. And he's, you know, this kid is madly in love with her, but he based her on three different people. But it's fascinating to find out who those actual people were at the time and the influence and power they had in French society. Because they were, you know, it'd be kind of like, I don't know who it would be like, 20 years ago, it would have been like, oh, I know Madonna, right? So, you know, I know the Princess Grefoule, I think she was a duchess. I'm not sure. There were three of them. So it would be like saying, I know somebody really important, right? So he was madly in love with these people, but then grew up and wrote this book and he strips away the truth behind the truth that hides the fact that they weren't really nice people. So his series of books, also seven, I like that number, is basically society gossip with this beautiful veneer of exquisite prose on top of it. But that's what he was doing. He was saying, I want to entertain you. Let's look at the truth about who these people were. So that's one of the books I'm reading. I just met and picked up, his book, a Canadian author named Ryan. Let me see if I get this right. Ryan Aldred. I met him at a reading event last week and his book is called Rum Luck. And it is a book about a drunken Canadian who buys a bar in Costa Rica and finds out the next day that the person he bought it from died. And gets in a lot of trouble because of it. But again, it's a very funny book. It's quite realistic on some level, but there are some pretty quirky characters and they have some very funny things to say. So I'm an omnivore when it comes to reading. If something isn't working for me, I'll put it down and maybe give it a try sometime later. So people say, how long does it take you to read a book? I say, it can take me years because I'll read three chapters and then not look at it again for another couple of years. Then something will pull me back to it. But yes, I will read anything you throw at me. Maybe not the telephone directory. Do we still have telephone directories? I actually think we don't anymore.
No, I think they're gone, but that's okay. I mean, I'm sure somebody's collecting them somewhere. Yeah. We had a thrift shop, you know, in 50 years, you know.
Yeah.
So how does this whole process, this whole book change you?
Well, it's kind of like birthing a child. You think, okay, thank God that's out of me. Let's see what it grows up to be, you know. I got probably the best review on a national level for this book than any other book that I've written, which was very rewarding. My mother's gone 3 years ago, but I can hear her saying, told you so. So that's good. I mean, you know, that sort of thing is great. I don't know if it's actually changed me. It's kind of like, okay, next project, let's get going on that. Cause you know, you've only got so many years left on earth and you can't waste them. You can't waste any of them. So it's just, you know, it's just. What's next? But for me, it's all, I'm in this incredibly lucky position where I can always say, what do I want to do next? As opposed to what do I have to do next? Right. Which I know a lot of people do. I get a lot of friends complaining to me about their jobs. I think, well, just give it up and write and you'll be poor in an instant, but you won't have a job to complain about.
Yeah. Yeah. I tell you. Nothing like it. No better life, except for when I was a prostitute. Now that was good.
That must have been colorful, but that's background, right?
So listen, where do people find you? Are you hanging out on the internet? Do you have social media? Do you have website, OnlyFans, hookup apps? Like where do people find Jeffrey Round?
Well, I won't give out my phone number. That's Phil Bolton. Facebook. And it's not even fancy. It's just Jeffrey Round. It's not even author or this or that. Totally open. You cannot leave a comment without my permission because I had some people leaving really strange things. And, I'll give you an example. One guy who was a big fan of my mysteries picked up my poetry book and then sent me this note on Facebook saying, what the fuck is this shit? There's no story here. I thought, okay, dude, you're totally in the wrong store here. So I stopped people from leaving messages on Facebook. My website, jeffreyround.com, that's, and you can join my mailing list as, you know, as people do with yours. I hope you found my address out there somewhere. Instagram, I am very weird with social media stuff. So it turns out I've got, because I didn't think the first one worked and I sent it out in the world and I thought, oh, that didn't work. And I set up another Instagram. I now have two Instagram accounts. So pick one. One is Jeffrey Round. The other is Jeffrey Round Author. Because once I set up the first one and thought it didn't work, I thought, well, now it won't let me use that name. I have to invent another name. But it turns out I've got two Instagram accounts. Twitter, I do the obligatory post on Twitter. I do read stuff that comes back. If somebody leaves me a comment, I'm definitely going to read it. Those are the basics. And if you want to find me hanging out at a bar, well, Black Eagle on Church Street, usually Sunday nights. I don't do Saturdays and Fridays. I don't like dealing with crowds. I'll be there on Sunday, you know, drinking my one beer because I am a driver. So I don't want to get picked up on the way home. Other than that, I don't know, send up smoke signals. If I see them, I'll answer them.
Well, there you have it. Now you know everything you need to know about Jeffrey Round, author. The book, The Sulphur Springs Cure. Everyone needs one. So thank you for being here.
Thank you. It was a pleasure as always. And let's keep writing.
This has been a production of the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our show, guests, or hosts, go to our website at houseofmysteryradio.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery Radio Show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show is over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Yeah. Good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.